in Eastern territory, and usually people who've studied this think that probably is about 733-732 B.C. 1 Chronicles 5:26 says, "So the God of Israel stirred up the spirit of Pul, king of Assyria, the spirit of Tiglath-Pileser," that's the name by which he is officially known, "king of Assyria, and he took them into exile," namely, and so at this point it's specific tribes, not the entire kingdom of northern kingdom, Israel, "Reubenites, Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh, and brought them to," and then place names are given in Assyria. These seem to be scattered places, so that seems to be a pattern for the Assyrians, is to deport a lot of the conquered people, replace them with people from other nations that had been conquered and so forth, and also to scatter them. And this is a large area. First of all, this is Tiglath-Pileser the III. The Assyrians have left some, for us, pictures of some of these people. So they're real people, of course. This is a picture of the 12 tribes, and after I chose this one, I remember that this is the original allotment, and Dan is pictured on the left side, partly along the Mediterranean, but and I failed to give you a reference to that, and I can't remember offhand where we know that from. But Dan was never able to take their allotment, and after some time they gave up and just simply moved north. So if you can see the town Dan in the far north, not very far from the term Arameans, somewhere up that way, the tribe of Dan actually moved. So I'll need to remember that as we go forward. At this point, though, if you can see on the right of the screen, Reuben, Gad, and half of Manasseh. Manasseh is split east and west. It's those east of the Jordan that are actually affected. Then 2 Kings 15:29, "In the days of Pekah, king of Israel," this is a little bit later, "Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, came and captured," and we have these place names, and among them Hazor, Gilead, Galilee. Okay, that's Gilead and Galilee in particular are ways of pointing again to places like Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh East, and so forth. Okay, deporting the conquered people was a special feature of the Assyrian policy. Perhaps they wanted to increase their labor force back in the kingdom itself, but also apparently they wanted to avoid any possibility of insurrection by simply leaving the conquered people at home. We also know that about this same time down south in the kingdom of Judah, the king is Ahaz, and he appeals to Tiglath-Pileser for protection. He says Syria and Israel are threatening me. By that appeal, he becomes a vassal of Assyria, and he made a tribute payment, silver and gold that was found in the house of the Lord in the temple. He took to make the payment, and in the treasures of his own kingdom. The fall of Israel, concluding in the actual fall of the capital city of Samaria, often referred to as Samaria, and then other times the northern kingdom as a whole is referred to as Samaria, is recorded in 2 Kings 17, 1 through 23. I made a note that Hosea is not the only one who warns of captivity. 1 Kings 14, I've noted here, the Lord will strike Israel as a reed is shaken in the water, and root up Israel out of his good land that he gave to their fathers, and scatter them beyond the Euphrates, because they've made their asherim, provoking the Lord to anger, and he will give Israel up because of the sins of Jeroboam. Okay, Jeroboam the first rebelled against Solomon. He put up the two golden calves. Everyone, or most everyone, has sinned in the same way that Jeroboam did, but quite often the reference is back to the source, Jeroboam the first, which he sinned and made Israel to sin. Okay, the last king in the north, the kingdom of Israel, is Hoshea. Going over my notes last night, I realized I mix up Hosea and Hoshea a few times. I think I've corrected all those, but you may be able to tell if I haven't. There is actually a seal. I can't refer you exactly to the source of that, where it is, where you would find it, but a seal from that time, it reads, belonging to Abdi, a servant of Hoshea. So this would be an artifact from the last days of the kingdom of Israel. Okay, Hoshea rules over what was left of the northern kingdom. What I mean by that is some of the early skirmishes happened before Hoshea is king over Israel, but he is the last, and he's put to death at the time of the fall of the city of Samaria. His ascent to the throne is recorded in 2 Kings 15:30 and 17:1, but also we would know that because Tiglath-Pileser himself, in his writings, says that he made Hoshea king over Israel. Okay, Hoshea is still there when the next Assyrian king comes along. That's Shalmaneser the V, 727 to 722. The fall of the capital city usually is dated 722. In this case, the Bible will tell us that Shalmaneser the V is the one who actually conquered the city. But in a moment, we'll see that the next Assyrian king, who probably put Shalmaneser the V to death about the same time, in his writings, he takes credit for it. So the shift from Shalmaneser the V to Sargon II takes place about that time. But the Bible tells us it's Shalmaneser the V, as one of his last actions, is successful in overthrowing the capital city. We already noted, as I recall a week or so ago, that Hosea makes a reference to what apparently is atrocities during an earlier time. He says Shalman, and most think that that is Shalmaneser that he refers to. Shalman destroyed Beth Arbel on the day of battle. Mothers were dashed in pieces with their children. Not that the Babylonians and other people who conquered biblical people weren't brutal as well, but the Assyrians were known for such things as beheading their captives, putting their eyes out, and more than once, I think once in Hosea, but more than once in Scripture, you will have reference to babes being dashed against the rocks and so forth. Okay, this is the end of Shalmaneser, and this is the image from Assyria that you have for Shalmaneser the fifth. Then in, again, 2 Kings 17:6, in the ninth year of Hoshea, at the end of his reign, the king of Assyria captured Samaria, and he carried the Israelites away to Assyria and placed them in, we have one, two, three, or more, and then the broad reference to the cities of the Medes. This is not so useful as I would like, but I included it because this gives me a sense of how far away they're taken. Down in the left-hand corner, we have Samaria and Jerusalem, and look at the great distance they're taken to Assyria, and then down to the bottom right, you're toward Babylon, that will be the next great power. But the great distance, I don't know how many captives were taken away, but they're scattered all over this vast area. 2 Kings 18:9 says, in the fourth year of King Hezekiah, this is King Hezekiah in Judah, the southern kingdom, which was the seventh year of Hoshea. So you're comparing king in the south and king in the north. Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, came up against Samaria and besieged it, and at the end of 3 years he took it. In the sixth year of Hezekiah, which was the ninth year of Hosea, king of Israel, Samaria was taken. The king of Assyria carried the Israelites away to Assyria and put them in, and I didn't include names, but again, several names scattered through the kingdom of Assyria. These aren't particularly useful. I can't identify specifically each one, but what I'm showing you is the type of things that the Assyrians recorded to describe. Well, there would have been similar things for other nations that they conquered, but these that I show you relate to the conquest of the Israelites. The Israelites are carrying bags on their backs here. Sometimes they look like their hands are tied. You have the, I can't read cuneiform, but you see the writing at the bottom of this image. Okay, the next Assyrian king is Sargon, who I've already said takes credit for the fall of Samaria. But likely Shalmaneser V accomplished it, and Sargon takes over at about the same time, and like many kings, wanted to take credit for it. And again, every time the exile is mentioned, there are several places scattered over a big country, the Assyrian Empire. Later now, in the 17th chapter of 2 Kings, you have a summary for the reasons for Israel's fall. She was exiled because of idolatry. And when you read those verses, 7 through 23, I didn't include those. It reads like a summary of all of the things that Hosea has said through the various chapters. And verse 9 in particular says, "They built for themselves high places in all their towns, from watchtower to fortified city." That simply means from the smallest village to the largest city, they had built Baal worship sites, altars, and so on and so forth, everywhere. This is Sargon the second, be the last in the story of conquest of Israel. Another thing that I think is significant, 2 Kings 17, the last part of the chapter is a description of taking other conquered peoples and bringing them into the territory that they have taken Israelites out of. And the king of Assyria brought people from Babylon, Cutta, other names, and placed them in the cities of Samaria instead of the people of Israel, replaced the people taken away. And they took possession of Samaria and lived in its cities. And at the beginning of their dwelling there, they did not fear the Lord. Therefore, the Lord sent lions among them, which killed some of them. So the king of Assyria was told, "The nations that you've carried away and placed in the cities of Samaria do not know the law of the God of the land. Therefore, he has sent lions among them, and behold, they are killing them, because they don't know the law of the God of the land." So the king of Assyria commanded, "Send there one of the priests whom you carried away from there, and let him go and live there and teach them the law of the God of the land." So one of the priests whom they carried away came and lived in Bethel and taught them how they should fear the Lord. And every nation still made gods of its own and put them in the shrines of the high places that the Samaritans had made, every nation in the cities in which they lived. Now understand what is being said. They come, or they're brought here, and they now have someone to teach them God's commands, but they also keep their religion. So it sounds like, well, we certainly have a mix of people, and we probably can assume that there was intermarriage, but we're actually told that these people are practicing two religions at this time, doing things that they've been taught by a priest that was brought back, but not giving up their own religion either. "This they do according to the former, to this day they do according to the former manner. So these nations feared the Lord and also served their carved images. Their children did likewise, and their children's children, as their fathers did, so they do to this day. Okay, it looks to me like we're describing a mix of people, and I think we would assume intermarriage, but also a great mixture of religion. Which brings the question of the Samaritans. There are some 900, I believe we're told, Samaritans that live today. What I'm suggesting is, after we've read that part of the chapter, we wonder, what's the result of the intermarriage and the mix of two different, at least two different types of religion? Who are the Samaritans? Are they the same as the people we would know today who are called Samaritans? Just what would be the case? Well, the Samaritans living in Palestine today actually claim to be, first of all, they say we're descendants of the tribe of Ephraim and Manasseh. We were left. Our ancestors were left. We weren't affected by the captivity. I think I already said they number about 900. I think it said that about 500 actually live in Israel and 400 live in the West Bank. And this is an oddity to me. I'm told the 400 have dual citizenship living in the West Bank. Supposedly, they view the Jews as close relatives, but believe that the Jews altered the original Israelite religion. So the religion that the Samaritans, the few of them living today, practice is different from Judaism. I failed to double check. I believe when I first found this picture, it was dated about 2006. It's a modern picture. These are the Samaritans on Mount Gerizim. That's their holy place. The high priest has two rolls there. I think that's referred to as the Samaritan Pentateuch, basically their version of the law of Moses. Okay, apparently this is what the modern Samaritans believe. They go back, they say, not to to 722, but our religion goes all the way back to Eli in the time of Samuel. But Eli is not their ancestor religiously. Eli, they say, was the false high priest who usurped the priesthood and built an alternative altar and temple at Shiloh. And then, of course, as you remember, that was moved to Jerusalem and eventually the temple built. Their place of worship, the right place, is Mount Gerizim. That's a basic difference between them, Jews, Jerusalem, and the Samaritans, Mount Gerizim. Gerizim is close to the modern town of Nablus and close to the ancient town of Shechem. Joshua led all the tribes there to the two mountains, Gerizim and Ebal. You may recall this. Half of the tribes were on the Gerizim side. They recited the blessings. The other half of the tribes were on the Mount Ebal side, and they recited the cursings. Well, it's Mount Gerizim that's holy for the Samaritans. You remember well Jesus' conversation with the Samaritan woman. Our fathers worshipped on this mountain, and she was looking up at Gerizim. But you say that in Jerusalem is the place where people ought to worship. John 4:20. There are many differences between Samaritans and modern Jews in their practice, but just to illustrate, the Samaritans have their own Ten Commandments, and the tenth commandment prescribes Mount Gerizim as the place of worship. Okay, Jews may have various opinions about Samaritans, but some of them, and then I've cited Josephus. Josephus lived in the first century. He would have been born a little bit after the crucifixion of Christ. Some of the Jews I know, and Josephus in particular, believed that the Samaritans were the Cuthites or Cuthians. 2 Kings 17:24, when it listed the places that people were brought from to repopulate Samaria, this is one of the places. And so that's one of the Jewish beliefs, that they were foreigners brought from that region of Assyria. Okay, the lost 10 tribes is an important question for a lot of people, and I'll use an example, I guess a prime example of that in a little bit. We really aren't told much about how many were taken out of Samaria and placed in various parts of Assyria. Josephus, I've given his dates here, late first century. Josephus is helpful a lot of times. He gives useful information for us that helps us understand certain biblical things. He says, though, here in the first century, there are two tribes in the Roman Empire, and the other 10 are still beyond the Euphrates, where they've been for 600-700 years. And they are an immense multitude, not to be estimated by numbers. I don't know exactly what he means, but he seems to be indicating maybe hundreds of thousands are in the millions. He says they're still there in the late first century, but we don't have anything else to go on. And many would question whether it's anything like that many that were there. During the earlier invasions, the tribes east of the Jordan and those to the north, we've already talked about that, a lot of them were deported. Some of the tribes seem indeed to have vanished. For instance, Reuben, Gad, Dan, Naphtali. See if I have the map. Okay, Reuben, Gad, you could see on the right. Naphtali to the north. And I've already talked about Dan actually being in another place than it's placed on this map. And actually Dan would be somewhere in the region of, or close to Naphtali, and you'll see that the town of Dan is actually in the Tan area of Naphtali. Okay, it's those four tribe names that are never mentioned again: Reuben and Gad east of the Jordan, Dan to the north, Naphtali to the north, and on the other side. Okay, there's a great deal of argument about the 10 lost tribes. We'll see in a moment that indeed there were people who survived, who were there at the conquest, but were not taken away. Many people would argue that the 10 lost tribes were never lost. They were here and there, and we could find them. Also, it'd be a question whether or not they were actually the Samaritans that we would know today. The only specific number that I know is Sargon II took credit, as I've said, for the fall of Samaria. And he says, in the first year of reign, which would have been that time, the people of Samaria, to the number of 27,290, he's specific, carried away. Well, many would believe there would be hundreds of thousands. I can't read this for you. This is a nine-sided prism, and it's one of the records of Sargon II. The writing is cuneiform. You can see how every side of the nine sides is written on it. Maybe that this is where he gives the number, but I'm not sure of that. The New Testament actually gives us an example of one of the tribes that survives, but obviously we don't hear much of it. Anna, daughter of Phanuel, the tribe of Asher, when the young Jesus had brought into the temple, she was there and rejoiced over him. We're told she didn't depart from the temple, worshiping and fasting and praying night and day, and she was there to meet the young Jesus. Okay, one of the groups that cares the most about the 10 lost tribes would be the Latter-day Saints, the Mormons. The Book of Mormons talks about two groups of Nephites that escaped Israel about 600 B.C. Between Assyria and Babylonian exiles. They supposedly built a ship, sailed across the ocean, arrived in the Americas, of course, centuries and centuries before Columbus. And these people, the Mormons believe, are the people that Jesus referred to in John 10:16. I have other sheep that are not of this fold. Okay, essentially the Mormons believe that the ancestors of these people are Native American Indians. They believe in the gathering of people from the 12 tribes. They say many of these people are descendants of the Israelites and they don't even know it. And they say the tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh will be gathered in the Americas and the tribe of Judah will return to Jerusalem and the surrounding areas. And according to Joseph Smith, the 10 lost tribes would receive their blessings through the tribe of Ephraim. Okay, you don't necessarily want a long lesson on Mormonism, but their belief is that Joseph Smith was the authority. He was given authority by the prophet Moses, they say, appeared to Smith in the Kirtland Temple in Ohio in 1836. Okay, quickly, Smith says, we believe in the literal gathering of Israel in the restoration of the 10 tribes, that Zion, the New Jerusalem, will be built on the American continent, that Christ will reign personally upon the earth, and that the earth will be renewed and receive its paradise. You probably already know that the Mormons believe that the Book of Mormons is actually something written on golden plates and found and translated about 1830 by Joseph Smith. Okay, more important than those things, the Bible itself will indicate that there are people that were left behind in Israel. The occasion will be King Hezekiah, a good king in the south in Judah, who invited members of the tribe of Ephraim, Zebulun, Asher, Issachar, and Manasseh to Jerusalem to celebrate the Passover after Samaria had already fallen. So we're told in this chapter that he wrote letters to Judah, of course, to invite everyone, but also to Israel. They should come to the house of the Lord at Jerusalem to keep the Passover to the Lord. O people of Israel, return to God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, that he may turn again to the remnant of you who have escaped from the hand of the kings of Assyria. So Hezekiah believes that they are there and that they were spared. Do not be stiff-necked as your fathers were, but yield yourselves to the Lord and come to his sanctuary, that his fierce anger may turn away. For the Lord your God is gracious and merciful and will not turn away from you if you return to him. Okay, verse 10 is interesting to me. It would be very hard, as maybe some of us would know, to go door-to-door evangelizing today in the same problem back in Hezekiah's day. People in Ephraim and Manasseh laughed them to scorn and mocked them. But, on the other hand, some men of Asher, Manasseh, and Zebulun humbled themselves and came to Jerusalem. The hand of God was on Judah to give them one heart and do what the king and the princes commanded by the word of the Lord. I may take a little time next week to go into this. King Josiah, that we've already talked about earlier, a good king, the boy king in Judah, just about a generation after Hezekiah, does almost the same thing. Now, the southern kingdom will be taken into captivity by the Babylonians, so all are not good in the sense of Hezekiah and Josiah. But the first thing is, we learn from both occasions that there were people in Israel, and the southern kings reached out to them. But the story is heartwarming in another way, and I'll save a comment on that to next time. Well, I hope I haven't bored you to death, but Hosea tells us very little about the exile itself. He simply warns that it's coming. But you can see both ancients and moderns were interested in the question of what happened to these people that were taken into exile. Well, thank you again.